Carbonite has backed up more than 500 billion files, from email servers to family photos. Learn more at carbonite.com.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Harley School, offering a college preparatory program emphasizing idea-driven exploration and problem-solving. Open house for nursery through grade 12 at 2:30 p.m. on Sunday, March 22nd. Details at harleyschool.org.
From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on Tuesday in Albany, where Assembly Democrats pushed a state budget plan that features a more aggressive schedule to raise the minimum wage. The current minimum wage in New York State, $8.75 an hour. Next year, it will rise to $9. Governor Andrew Cuomo has proposed raising it in 2017 to $10.50 an hour. Assembly Democrats, led by new Speaker Carl Hastie, want more. They agree with the governor that the minimum wage should be $10.50 in 2017. Then in 2019, Assembly Democrats want the state minimum wage to rise to $12.60, and from that point forward, they want the state minimum wage attached to inflation. That way, advocates say, the wage wouldn't fall behind every year. But business leaders have largely opposed these ideas, warning that an aggressive increase in the minimum wage could hurt business, particularly small businesses, which could end up laying off some workers. So let's explore where things stand with the minimum wage. My guest in studio, Greg Barilla, is here. He's the executive director of Unshackle Upstate, a pro-business advocacy group based here in Rochester. Greg, nice to see you.
Thank you for having me on, Evan.
Colin O'Malley is here, the organizing director for Metro Justice, which is a community social justice organization of about 1,000 members here in Western New York. Colin, nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, and later this hour, we're going to hear more about small business impact. I think in about a month, we're going to talk a little bit more about the Fight for 15, which Colin is not an official spokesperson for the Fight for 15, but we're going to talk fast food impact as well, because a lot of the question on $15 minimum wage goes back a few years that was started in many ways by fast food workers. But let's start with what New York State is considering right now. Greg Barilla, Unshackle Upstate is opposing what Assembly Democrats want. Do you also oppose what Governor Cuomo wants, which is to take it from $9 in 2016 to $10.50 in 2017?
We do oppose.
Okay. And give me a sense for why the position is what you're taking right now.
Primarily, in 2013, the state raised the minimum wage on a graduated scale that's going to finally go into full effect at the end of this year. So we have not even seen the impacts of that minimum wage increase yet. Before that's even done, Albany is already talking about the next minimum wage increase. And unfortunately, when you increase a cost, particularly labor costs on businesses, there's four places for that money to go. They can cut jobs and cut hiring. They can reduce hours. They'll book lower profits. Or they'll raise prices on everybody across the state. We don't think any of those four items are objectives of anyone. And before this current phase in is complete, we think we need to wait and see what the damage is.
All right, give me those four again, because I want to kick it over to Colin in a second. Give me those four again. You're worried that if the state minimum wage is aggressively raised in the way that mm-hmm. they're talking, that businesses will either cut jobs, raise prices, they will retain lower profits, or what's the fourth?
Reduce hours, which is similar to cutting jobs.
All right, so cut jobs entirely or reduce hours. Colin O'Malley, do you agree that those are four possible outcomes?
I think the outcomes to raising the minimum wage can be really varied. I think those are four of some of the possible outcomes. I'm sure there are a great deal more. More importantly, I'd like to just step back a second. And, I think that this conversation often gets bogged down in a really sort of overly academic and economic and like macroeconomic conversation. And what we often lose is the real just base moral problem here. We have people, millions of people across the country, across New York State, working all the time, working full time, trying to raise families and ultimately living in poverty. We're talking about poverty all the time in Rochester right now. And it's a rare day when I hear the low wages that people are making being shown to being pointed out as a consistent problem there. And in fact, I would argue that it's the largest problem.
Certainly, we have seen, even with the success of the Dow, for example, and the markets over the last, really since end of 2009 and the surge we've seen, we've seen wage stagnation, and no one debates that. That certainly is an issue, wage stagnation in this country. You see presidential candidates on the left and the right talking about that. And so, Colin, what you're saying is that if you're working, you shouldn't be in poverty. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Okay. And I want to start with you on that point and then get back over to Greg, because in the last 15 months, we've had a lot of conversations on this program about poverty, about minimum wage, and about what the minimum wage is supposed to be. For example, Brian Kolb is the Assembly Minority Leader. He agrees with a lot of Republicans, certainly not all, but a lot, who say the minimum wage is not intended to support a family of four, for example. It's supposed to be an entry-level wage, and that we have lost sight of what it's supposed to be if we're pushing it in the direction you want. What do you say to that?
You know, I think that that's a wonderful fantasy world to live in, right? I think that the reality is it's totally untrue. I mean, if you live in poverty in this country, I grew up in poverty. I grew up with my mother working at a hotel, working at McDonald's. If you grow up in those circumstances, you know that that's not true. When I talk to fast food workers in town and I see them, you know, trying to raise a family at Wendy's, I know that that's not true. You know, when you look at who's earning minimum wage or who would likely benefit from a small increase in the minimum wage, really namely those that are making like 20 cents over, 30 cents over the minimum wage, you find that huge numbers of them are, you know, in their 30s, right, in their 40s, in their 50s. I know a gentleman who's like 63 with six children and he's earning 10 an hour.
Okay. So Greg, what do you make of the comment of what the minimum wage is designed to be? Is it supposed to be an entry-level wage or should it support a family?
I have to take the converse opinion. I think it is supposed to be an entry-level wage and a training wage, and it provides most individuals, including my own, you know, first working experience where you learn the skills of being an employee at the most basic level, taking direction, personal accountability. Those are skills that allow you to get your next job. And what raising the minimum wage will do will continue to create more competition for the lowest wage jobs, pushing out the very people that minimum wage increase supporters are purporting to help. You're going to create a position or a situation in New York State where young adults who don't have high school education are not able to compete for the lowest wage jobs. They're going to be completely kept out of the job market.
What happens then, Colin? You disagree with that premise?
Yeah, I totally do. And in fact, I think it's worth highlighting, you know, that the conversation around minimum wage in this country tends to be muddied by, I think, very weak sort of supposed common sense economic analysis that is that's really a muddied water conversation based on mass profit influence, right? So studies have been done. I've got a study in front of me here from the Institute on Research and Labor Employment about the impact on teen employment specifically, right? So let's, you know, if we really are going to talk about it, let's talk about what people say. At the end of their report, they say, put simply, our findings indicate that minimum wage increases in the range that have been implemented in the United States do not reduce employment among teens. You know, I think over and over again, we find that studies make it very clear on these questions. And at the end of the day, I think they're muddied by those that typically represent major industries like McDonald's and Walmart.
So what you're pointing to and what you're offering is the notion that an increase in minimum wage could reduce employment. You're saying red herring.
Absolutely. Consistently a red herring.
All right. But this is where I want to make sure I understand where you are on this, Colin. I've done my best to talk to economists. Here in Rochester, I talk to Kent Gardner at the Center for Governmental Research quite often. I've never thought of someone like Kent with a dog in the fight or with an ideological stance. I guess we all have our own ideological stances, but I don't think that he is going to bat for anybody. And the basic idea I get is this. If you increase the minimum wage gradually, that if there's disruption, it would be minimal. But if you took the minimum wage overnight, say to $15, there almost certainly would be disruption. There almost certainly would be some layoffs at some level. And I don't think anybody knows exactly what that is. Because if you took the minimum wage to $30 an hour, let's have a thought experiment, of course there are going to be layoffs. So if the question is, if you triple the minimum wage, will there be layoffs? Almost certainly. Then at some point down closer to zero, there's less disruption. But what is acceptable? And do you at least agree that if the minimum wage went to $30 overnight, we'd see layoffs, right?
I don't know. I probably, but I have no idea.
Okay. So,
and in fact, I think it's a hard question to study because nobody's ever done that.
Okay. Well, that is true. That is true. But people like Kent say, you know, it's a non-zero disruption and we don't know what it is. What you're saying is study after study indicates it's minimal or doesn't exist. But do those studies look at taking the minimum wage from $8.75 to, say, $12.60 in a couple of years? I mean, we're talking about a 35 or 40% increase.
Look, you know, I mean, economists do analysis of what has happened. right, and what is going on. So what they can do is look back on past moments, right?
Sure.
What political philosophers do and ideologues do is talk about what could happen, right? And that's totally speculative. What I do know, and again, I'm actually looking at a study here mm-hmm. of this is a study of studies that looks at like those studies those studies that have been most precise, most rigorous, have shown that there tends to be right here. I'm saying in any case, with 64 studies containing approximately 1,500 estimates, we have reason to believe that that if there is some adverse employment effect from minimum wage raises, it must be of small and policy irrelevant magnitude. And more importantly, what they find in the study is that if you look across a variety of studies, those that are less rigorous, those that are weaker, and I'll just be totally honest, I think those that are muddied by corporate influence tend to have much more severe implications.
Okay, in a moment, I want to ask Colin, because we haven't even ascertained what would Unshackle Upstate, what would Metro Justice like to see for a minimum wage. We're talking about what's being debated in Albany now, but what would we like to see outside of what Albany's talking about? We're going to get to that in a second. Greg, go ahead with a rebuttal there.
Well, you get into an interesting conversation. We start talking about studies because anyone who's looked at enough of them knows that they'll tell you whatever you're looking for if you look long enough. But another study, just speaking to our exact point about young employees, looked at New York. Economists from Cornell, San Diego State, and University of Oregon looked at when New York raised the minimum wage between 2004 and 2006 by $1.60. Employment dropped by more than 20% for individuals aged 16 to 19 who lacked a high school diploma. That's right in New York. So I think that evidence that sort of occurrence in the economy is possible.
That's the Cato Institute study, right?
I don't have that.
Yeah,
I just have those three gentlemen's names.
Okay. If you want to jump in, I see the phone starting to ring. I should mention it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WX6I, 263-9994. Greg, what would Unshackle Upstate want for a minimum wage? Or let me reframe that question. Should there be a minimum wage?
That's a really deep question. I think there probably should be a minimum wage. Unshackle Upstate, at this moment in time, thinks our minimum wage in New York is probably where it should be. We just implemented it, as I said before. We need to see what that's going to do to the economy, particularly small employers, particularly upstate, where we rely on small businesses. You saw some business leaders out of New York City say, we're all for raising the minimum wage. Those employer organizations don't represent small businesses. Of course, Goldman Sachs and Verizon and Coca-Cola don't care as much about raising the minimum wage. We're talking about small employers upstate New York. I think we need to take a look at the impacts of this last increase, understand its impact before we talk about raising it again.
Okay. Colin, what should the minimum wage be?
You know, I'm hesitant to give an exact number because I think that you know, we need to be as democratic as possible in these kind of conversations. Given where we're at right now, I am very excited to support the efforts of fast food workers pushing for 15 in their industry in conversation about what the minimum wage should be. I'm most excited right now by what's in front of me coming from the Assembly Democrats. What it could hypothetically be, I think, is a conversation that doesn't really matter at this point. However, if we're given that wages have stagnated for about 40 years in this country, profitability of your average worker hasn't stagnated. So I think it's worth pointing out that that if you were to, in 1968, at the minimum wage's highest point, tie it to productivity, that is the amount of money being made by the average worker's hour of work.
$21.72
would be the minimum wage today.
Yeah, that's according to the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
Yeah. And so what that shows us is over the last 40 to 50 years, your wage workers in this country have been getting an increasingly smaller and smaller piece of the pie. And I don't think we should be shocked at the outcomes of that. The outcomes of that are cities with 35% poverty rates.
All right, but that begs its own question. And so let me say that again. The minimum wage would be $21.72 an hour, and that's as of 2012, if it kept up increases in worker productivity, according to the Center for Economic and Policy Research. But Colin, does that mean, would you buy the idea that the minimum wage should be $21 or $22 an hour?
What I think it does is, I think the $21 an hour to me is not about saying that that's the minimum wage I would propose tomorrow. It's to highlight that we've gone 40 years of inequitable gains in this country that have led to some of the greatest degree of wealth inequality we've ever seen.
People doing more for less.
Yeah, I mean, you see, it's that old adage, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, right? That is exactly what we've been seeing for 40 years in this country. And you know, and it leads me to really, I think, the answer from Upstate, Unshackle Upstate on this question. You know, if you're happy with where the minimum wage is now, that's interesting because you opposed it when it last came up, and you opposed the one before that when it last came up. So, you know, I would really read the hesitancy about whether or not the minimum wage should be increased as an
He didn't say he was happy with it. He's saying, I think, let's see what happens with more time.
Certainly, but the organization, as far as I know, has yet to ever support an increase in the minimum wage. So would you be happy with it at 425 where it was in the 90s?
I think what I said is the position of the organization that, I mean, we can look back and say what would be best, but it is what it is. And Evan asked me what I think the minimum wage should be, mm-hmm. not what I think it should have been. I think the minimum wage should be what it is in New York State. And we should allow the scheduled increases to go through before we talk about increasing it again.
When it comes to attaching to inflation, Greg, I'm going to assume Unshackle opposes attaching to inflation.
Again, so what you do when you attach to inflation is it increases in perpetuity.
That's right.
Which eventually, I think, is the goal of some people, in perpetuity.
Well, it wouldn't design it to increase in perpetuity. It would design it so it wouldn't fall behind. I mean, obviously, unless we end up in stagflation, or if we have inflation every year, if the value of a dollar, if you get less for a dollar, then effectively, if I make $8.75 an hour in 2012, if I'm making that same wage in 2015, I am making less, correct?
Correct.
Okay, effectively less. So that's why they'd want to attach it to inflation. And again, economists are not I think there's some split into whether or not you could manipulate what inflation would look like to change the wage. So I think there are some questions about how it would work. But in general, you're saying opposed.
And here's the problem with that.
Okay.
When you talk to business owners, again, particularly small business, the ones that will be hurt the hardest by a minimum wage increase, one of the biggest problems with Albany and with government, not just on minimum wage, but on a host of issues that we could spend five shows talking about, is the unpredictability. And that's part of the problem with raising it again. There's a business has to look at its books every year, every month, look at their labor costs, and they have to balance that with their other costs, month in, month out. Year to year, when they don't know how much their labor costs, they're going to, again, like we discussed before, do one of those four things. Pull their money out of their business, seek to not invest it in their business, fail to hire, fail to add more hours, book less profits, or eventually what most will do, it's just the rule of economics, is they'll charge more for their services.
Okay. So of those four things, again, and Greg has been talking about the four possible impacts if we see a minimum wage go up. Job cuts, reduction in worker hours, raising prices, or lower profits. Colin, again, we go back to that. And if those things pan out, would it change your position as to what the minimum wage should be?
Yeah, but there's no data saying that they've ever panned out. So I'm sort of, you know, when he says the law of economics, like I studied economics, I don't remember seeing that law of economics anywhere. I would flip it and say the exact opposite, the exact from the same perspective. If every single year you're making less and less money, but costs are going up, you similarly have choices to make. And those choices are things like, do I pay my bills or do I feed my children? Do I pay my rent and become homeless and not become homeless? Or do I pay for health care? You know, those sort of choices, I think, are very, very common choices living in a city as poor as we have. And the fact that we consistently in national politics and often in state politics defer to business ideology on this stuff and not to everyday working people's experiences, I think is a moral travesty.
All right. Last question before I get to the phones, because I know the phones are lit up. But let me at least ask this. We're not going to get Greg and Colin to agree on what the minimum wage should be. There is a divide there. Colin, again, from Metro Justice, saying the minimum wage ought to be a living wage. It ought to support a family. You should not be in poverty if you are working. And Greg saying, we've all worked minimum wage jobs. It's a training wage. It's an entry-level wage and part of the journey of work.
Supplemental wage.
Supplemental wage. Okay. I know you're not going to agree on that, but we do agree that wage stagnation has happened in this country. We see more jobs at lower wages. How do we change that? Greg, I think that's related to this conversation.
I think it is too.
And how do we fix that?
And I'm not I'm certainly not equipped to speak on a national level, but I can speak to a New York State level.
Sure.
You know, I think where Colin and I agree is that we'd like to see wages increase, and we'd like to see more and more people making more and more money, adding to the local economy and the state economy. Myself and my organization believes the best way to do that is through competitive market forces. And now you can make the argument that we're not seeing that on a national level, but New York State isn't in a competitive market. We have the highest business taxes, highest personal taxes. I mean, when I say the highest, I mean top five in almost any reputable study or business magazine. Our energy costs are top five in the country. Our healthcare costs are top five in the country. We have laws and regulations that other states have banned years ago. So to compete and survive and run a business in New York State, you're already at a competitive disadvantage. Now you're adding additional labor costs in a form of a wage mandate from Albany.
All right. So Greg is saying wage stagnation's real. Too much pressure and downward pressure on businesses impacting wages. That's why there's a lot of low-wage jobs.
That's why why it's particularly upstate, why we continue to see a much slower economic recovery than the rest of the state and the rest of the country. And I would even argue economic stagnation.
Okay. Colin, stagnated wages. Let's get about fixing it. What way?
Raising wages. It's very simple. The majority of low-wage workers, like two-thirds of low-wage workers in this country, are not employed by small business. They're employed by companies like Walmart that have 1.4 million workers. They're employed by McDonald's that has like 750,000 workers in this country, right? And whenever we say that low-wage businesses can't uphold the small businesses can't uphold the burden, we're giving these organizations a pass. And honestly, if you talk to their own small businesses, there's a lot of these groups like Unshackle Upstate that claim to represent small business. But if you look at some of their own stuff, right, like the National Federation of Independent Businesses actually did a study of what your single most important problem for a small business is, a survey across the board. And they found that over and over, poor sales are a considerably higher problem for them. Like 10 times as many people in the last survey said that poor sales was a problem more so than cost of labor. And what they're really saying there is the real problem that they're facing is that the low-wage workers in other fields are earning too much to be their customers or ever shop there. So the amount of money that would be infused into the economy by forcing things like Walmart and Burger King and McDonald's to pay real wages, I think ultimately is a boon to small business.
In just a moment, I'm going to bring in someone from NFIB, the New York State director, and he can respond to that, Colin. But even if the premise you lay out is true when it comes to Walmart, big companies, it's as opposed to small business, should there be different rules for smaller companies compared to some of those bigger companies you say? Do we lump them all together too much?
You know, I don't. I think so. Metro Justice doesn't have a position on that, and so I couldn't speak as an organization. But I personally think it's totally reasonable that there be distinctions there. I think the central problem in our country right now is massive, massive wealth and income inequality. And when I think of who the people are that are walking away with most of the wealth of society, it typically is not a small business owner. And what I find to be problematic with the notion that these sort of moments are about small business people is that they're actually in much larger aggregate terms about Walmarts and McDonald's.
All right, let me bring in Mike Durant, who is the New York State Director of NFIB, who is on the line with us now. And Mike, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you, Evan. Happy to be here.
Well, you heard Colin referred to a number of points there, and I'll just sort of let you respond in general. I know you've been hearing some of the conversation so far. When it comes to the impact of small businesses, Colin is essentially saying that we're overplaying small business in this, that it is big companies, by and large, that are part of what he perceives as the problem. What do you think?
Well, first, a little bit about NFIB. I have the privilege of representing nearly 11,000 small and independent businesses all across the state. The typical NFIB member in New York has between 5 and 7 employees, and they net before they pay themselves, all their bills, their taxes, et cetera, their employees. They net anywhere from $450,000 to $800,000. So we're not talking about Walmart, McDonald's, Burger King, et cetera. I think that as I've listened to this conversation since it started at 1 o'clock, what you're seeing is why this issue does get bogged down and why the other side, the advocates for minimum wage, and I'm not singling out your guests, but I'm saying just in general here in Albany, is you paint business with a broad brush. You've just seen Walmart arbitrarily on their own decide to increase their wages, and that's very laudable, and that's great. But we're dealing with, and the people that I represent, a pizza place, say that, you know, employs five people. The price of the goods is increasing. The price of gas has been high. It's a little lower now, but it ebbs and flows. But the price of grain, of vegetables, of meat, those things on the pizza. And then you increase the minimum wage, plus the tip worker wage is going up. The business, that pizza place, is not all of a sudden going to sell, in whatever their market is, 50 new pizzas or 75 new pizzas to absorb that cost. So something is going to happen, and Greg has made points about reducing hours, et cetera. Now, as the NFIB study that was used, yes, sales are a problem, but that study is conducted by NFIB across all 50 states. That's not a New York-specific study. When I talk to our members, and we ballot our members every year, it's healthcare, it's taxes, it's regulation. And that's the other problem with minimum wage is, yes, everybody deserves to earn the best compensation, whether benefits, wages, et cetera, that's available in that the business can provide. The problem is you look at this as a vacuum, and when you see polls on minimum wage and it polls 80, 85% want an increase, everybody wants salary increases. Of course it's going to pull that high. New York has top five energy costs in the country, top five healthcare costs in the country. Unemployment, workers' comp, et cetera, are all extremely high, and the Walmarts, the big box stores, the chains, they can absorb those costs, but a small business, most of which don't even have human resource offices, that's a lot for them to take in a short amount of time. So you have to differentiate between what's going on at the $15 an hour push for McDonald's, et cetera, versus the impact that it will have on small employers.
All right, well, my couple of things here. The average company you represent employs how many people?
5 to 7.
That's a small business. Colin is saying, you know, he's not taking a position one way or another immediately on the question of should we have different rules for legitimate small businesses versus Walmart, for example. But should we?
Well, there are some states that have enacted minimum wage rules that say don't look at or would exclude, say, a business that has three or fewer employees, et cetera. I just think that, you know, it's not something – it would be something we would ballot our members to see how they felt. If it became an issue here in New York, it's no different than you're seeing arguments now that there should be a regional minimum wage. You've had folks in Long Island say it should be 15. New York City saying it should be 15. Westchester saying 15. There's no doubt that we have multiple different economies across New York. It's a very diverse state, and the standard of living varies based on state. And there's no doubt that there's a poverty issue. There is one in Rochester. There's one in Syracuse. There's one in Watertown. The best way for individuals to have not only job opportunities, and this is always NFIB's position, job opportunities is to have a sensibly regulated state, have a sensibly clear, consistent, concise tax code in this state, because then business, one, will offer more compensation, and two, be able to expand and hire more. The issue on poverty is, and this is a national stat, not in New York, but nearly 60% of those in poverty don't have an employment opportunity right now. Job is the best social tool to reduce poverty, but we need to get them employed, and you can't have a hostile environment like New York has to small business.
All right, before I get to a break, and I'm way late for a break, and I want to get to more of our phone calls. Mike, can you hang in with us for a while here?
Absolutely.
Mike Durant's on the line. He's the New York State Director of the National Federation for Independent Business. Colin O'Malley, the Organizing Director for Metro Justice, is here. Greg Barilla is the Executive Director of Unshackle Upstate. Colin, you hear Mike saying the best solution to poverty are more jobs available. Do we have an environment, especially in Rochester, where poverty is perhaps a more acute problem than anywhere else in the country for a city its size? Do we have a job availability problem?
You know, I think there certainly is a job availability problem, but when you look at Rochester by comparison to other cities around the country, we don't have a markedly higher unemployment rate compared to urban centers. We do have a markedly higher poverty rate. So when the unemployment in the city is somewhere between 10 and 12%, and the poverty rate in the city is like 35%,
It's almost 36%, and roughly half of that is extreme poverty.
Yeah, and so we're looking at a situation where much of the poverty is created. Many of the people in poverty are working, and I absolutely think that these big box folks are the main perpetrator of that and the main problem there. And I hope that the NFIB would get on board with supporting a $15 an hour wage at Walmart. But what you've seen in Seattle, where this sort of a $15 an hour wage has been put forward specifically on some of these big employers, is that groups much like Unshackle have put forward suit against the city, citing the 14th Amendment, which is the amendment that granted equal rights to former slaves. That's the problem for them. So the second you start to differentiate, they make incredible legal cases to say that you can't differentiate. So if small business folks and small business coalitions are going to stand in the way of eliminating poverty for tens of thousands of people, then I think their models are deeply, deeply flawed.
Greg, how much are you looking at Seattle? And Los Angeles, by the way, is considering it. We see other places considering 15. How much are we going to watch Seattle? Or is it too much apples and oranges?
Well, it's certainly a little bit of apples and oranges when you talk about particularly upstate cities. I don't think anyone would confuse the economy of Seattle with the economy of Buffalo, Rochester, or Syracuse. But there's also some issues when you talk about differentiating communities within its own state, which some cities across the country are just trying to do or talking about doing. It really creates a very unique economic problem. County lines, what someone can make at a different store is completely different, or what someone can make at the same store that may be 10 feet apart is completely different. It creates a almost a cannibalizing competitive sense within communities. So it's something that, while, again, Unshackle Upstate hasn't really had a formal opinion on it, is something I question.
All right, I've got to get to a break, and then I want to get to your phone calls. And thanks, everyone, for waiting. Let's take that very short break and talk more about the New York State minimum wage debate next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. On the next Connections, it's Education Friday. We'll talk about the slave trade through the voices of children. An RIT professor tells us those stories in his new book. Then we'll talk about a crisis in the humanities. What's going on with higher education, and how are they reaching more students, attracting them to the humanities? We'll talk about all of that, Education Friday on Connections.
I do feel like I've always been a fairly private person leading a public life.
Hillary Clinton's efforts at privacy surfaced in the State Department email controversy. It's a struggle that goes back to her days as First Lady looking for a zone of privacy.
After resisting for a long time, I've been rezoned.
That story today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. Just resetting the discussion for you. New York State's minimum wage is $8.75 an hour. Next year, it will rise to $9 an hour. Governor Andrew Cuomo has proposed raising it in 2017 to $10.50 an hour. And Assembly Democrats announced this week that, yes, they'd like to see it at $10.50 an hour starting in 2017, but they want to see it go to $12.60 by 2019, and at that point, attach it to inflation. And so we're seeing a discussion on what happens and who supports it and who doesn't. And there are a lot of opinions that have been making their way to Albany and onto this program as well this week. I'll also let you know that next month we're going to try to focus a little bit more on fast food workers. And I know we're going to talk about what they call their fight for 15. That will also include us reaching out to the business community as well. So we're going to do our best to bring as many voices to this discussion as we can. Let's get to the phones now. And this is Dan in Brockport. Go ahead, Dan.
Hi, Evan. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Man, where do we begin? I'll tell you what. It boggles my mind that we have the same discussion in our politics over and over every year. Every year we talk about the minimum wage and raising the minimum wage and cutting Social Security. And it's the same discussion over and over and over every year. And we never really get anything done. Even if we get the minimum wage raised, we don't get much. And it's nowhere near $21 an hour. So I think the problem here is that we're in need of a paradigm shift in the way we look at this entire situation. I mean, where there is a difference between work and a job. You know, freelancers work, don't have a job, aren't eligible for minimum wage. Homemakers work and aren't eligible for minimum wage. We tie everything to a job, and jobs are scarce, and they're becoming more scarce all the time as things continue to automate automation is going to take everybody's job eventually. We need to look at like a basic income model that replaces the minimum wage. You're not going to find anybody more liberal than I am. And I don't support a minimum wage increase because I think the minimum wage is the wrong way to go. What would Chris Rock say? If I could pay you less, I would. If it wasn't against the law, you know.
But what do you want to do? What's the alternative then, Dan?
The alternative is a basic income model where we restructure our entire social safety net. Unemployment insurance, welfare, Social Security, we restructure it all. We don't have any minimum wage whatsoever. We give everybody a basic income, the same check, unconditional, universal. Everybody gets the same amount of money. There's no shame in it. There's no necessity or requirement tied to it. You get your basic income and let the chips fall where they may on unemployment. If you can afford to pay your employees $5 an hour, and that's what you pay them. If you can pay them $20, then that's what you pay them. If people have a basic income, then they can decide for themselves what pursuits that they want to pursue. Maybe they don't want to work for your company for $10 an hour. You might have to pay them $12. It's not a question of paying everybody a minimum wage. The minimum wage doesn't do it. It doesn't do it between New York City and, you know, upstate New York where we live. The difference there is a wage number isn't going to be acceptable in both those places.
All right, Dan,
And we're never going to get past that.
Well, let me let the panel weigh in. Thank you for the call, Dan. Colin, he's saying don't raise the wage, replace it entirely. Yes or no?
Yeah, you know, I actually agree with almost everything he said, and I think he's just sort of letting the perfect be the enemy of the good. I do think our entire nation needs a deeply felt paradigm shift in our economy on almost every front. We need to figure out how to genuinely redistribute wealth in this country in a major, major way. Wealth inequality is absolutely the number one problem that I think leads to nearly every other problem after it. I'm here talking about the minimum wage because it's been offered by the New York State Assembly. It's been pushed by the governor. I would love to believe that we had politicians that more thoroughly talked about what a real paradigm shift would be.
What Dan is talking about.
I hope one day we have the politicians that will actually talk about those sort of policies. And in the meantime, we're not going to let the perfect be the enemy of the good. One of those major shifts that I would say in this country right now, and it's replicated in the fast food movement out there, is that they're not just saying 15 an hour. Everyone's talking about 15 an hour. They're also saying a union. And when we have 6% of our private workforce in this country in unions, working people have a very weak collective voice. And it leads to the sort of policies like we're at, and it leads to the inability to get a paradigm shift like Dan's talking about to the table.
I can't imagine Greg Brilla and Unshackle Upstate agree with that. Go ahead, Greg.
No, and I mean, Dan's comment kind of got into the philosophical a little bit and is sort of a giant hypothetical. But the idea of universal welfare, I guess, is the best way I can describe his proposal, is not something I think we would support. And I think it goes against a lot of what has built this economy and others may not agree with me 100%, but have made this country great. And that's the incentive to work, the incentive to succeed, motivation, innovation. All that is driven by our economy.
Is there a moral hazard, Colin, to knowing that there is a safety net if you don't work I think what Greg is saying, that incentive to work and to produce has to be there.
You know, can I just actually say that the way I hear that as somebody who grew up in a poor family is very different. It's not an incentive to work. It's a work for me at these wages or starve. I think it's, in fact, a threat. And so I think if destitution is taken off the table and people won't work, then that means that the style of work and the type of work they're being asked to do is asinine. And so I think we need to shift to a totally different framework in our economy, and that what Dan's talking about is a great way to do that. We should absolutely take poverty and the risk of destitution and homelessness off the table so we can have real choice in our economy, but we don't have that. And I consistently find groups like Unshackle Upstate supporting the continued ability of companies to threaten everyday working people in that way.
Okay, I don't think Greg feels like he's making a threat, but go ahead and respond, Greg.
No, I don't feel like I'm making a threat, and I'm certainly not making any personal insinuations towards anybody. I just think you look at a lot of the problems we have with our current welfare system, particularly in New York State. I don't think expanding that to every Tom, Dick, and Harry in the state is any way to begin discussing our economic future.
Let me get back to the phones. Waiting has been Paul in Brighton. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, there's a lot going on here, obviously. It's hard to quite know where to begin. It does appear that there are macroeconomic factors that are really going to be determining not just wages, but the nature of work, the nature of consumption. I don't want to introduce a polemical item here, but, you know, Karl Marx said, from each according to his ability to each according to his needs. And most of us certainly reject that as a whole, but maybe we are moving towards something like that, at least on the maybe not from, but the to part, which is that what seems to be advocated here by some people, like Dan, who just called, is that we should all receive something. And the next question is, who should provide that something? Who should provide the sustenance? Large portion of the population that may be unable to produce. I'll let people respond to that.
Thanks for the call, Paul. Colin, you want to take that?
Yeah, you know, I think I really think of the sort of dual conversation about our social safety net and wages is a really fundamental one. And in fact, right now, I think the way that they're tied together is really shown in the way that group companies like Walmart and McDonald's abuse our social safety net. Right? When Walmart workers can rely on public assistance programs due to their low wages. And you know, there's a study I'm looking at here that says about $6.2 billion of low-income programs have gone to Walmart employees. Really what we're telling Walmart is, don't worry, you don't have to pay a reasonable wage, and you can still rake in billions in profits. We'll cover you on the other end. And so we subsidize those low wages as a society. And then on the other hand, the food stamps that many McDonald's and Burger King and Walmart workers all get go back to Walmart. So they bring in about $13.5 billion in income and revenue from the food stamp the food stamp program. So I don't think we should get rid of those programs. I think they should be strengthened. But I think one of the ways we strengthen them is by requiring these big businesses to pay fairly.
All right. Now I'm going to bring in Mike and Greg here, but Greg's predecessor, Brian Sampson, is listening along online and writes to us on Twitter. A question for Colin. Does Colin believe that a 16-year-old should get $15 an hour? Shouldn't the state instead boost the earned income tax credit to help those in need? And we have heard some economists say the earned income tax credit is a much more efficient way to address problems, inequality, et cetera. But let's start with the first part of his question. 16-year-olds in the workforce, should you have to pay them, you know, $15 an hour, for example?
You know, the threat there that I think is important for folks to know is that wages are relative, right? If you can hire any group of people at a particularly low wage, you may go out and do that, right? So when one body of people makes incredibly low wages, that puts a downward pressure on everyone else's wages. So while it might sound like good logic, I actually think that that's another way that these sort of business groups are looking to apply downward pressure to wages, which have been down for 50 years.
What about the income tax credit? And that may be a separate discussion, but what do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think that the earned income tax credit is a great thing. It's been a great way of putting money into the hands of working people. It shouldn't be a substitute for paying people for labor. People are putting in work and creating profit for these companies and organizations. They should get a share of that profit.
Mike Durant?
The earned income tax credit in New York, if you compare both what the federal government kicks in the state, we're talking almost $5 billion, $4.5 to $5 billion a year, almost or roughly right around $1 billion of it coming from the state. So you had the caller, basically two callers previously, talk about a living wage. In many instances, and the minimum wage was never meant to be a living wage. For those that are truly working poor that are making minimum wage, there is the earned income tax credit and a lot of other social programs that our money is going to. If you're talking about a complete paradigm shift, that goes far beyond minimum wage. It goes far beyond a whole host of things. You'd have to look at the tax structure and business climate of the state. You'd have to look at how much money, our money, tax money from all of us, is going to social programs. You'd have to look at our costs in health care and workers' comp and UI. It would be a total overhaul of the system. But please bear in mind that there is this issue that you want employment opportunities, you need to be skilled, which brings in the education component to it, or workforce training. There's a lot spinning around. At the end of the day, and very simply, the difference between the Walmarts and the people that Colin's talking about, and the difference between the people I represent, and a lot of these people that I represent on Shackle Upstate and other the chambers, a lot of business groups, and we've had 18 of them yesterday signed a letter, all represent. We need to have a state that is sensible in its social policies, in its economic policies. We need to look at why we're so high taxed and why that strangles economic opportunity, and rejig it. Sure, the paradigm, but that's very complicated, and I'm not sure. In a lot of areas, you're going to see too many lawmakers on any side of the aisle at any level of government be willing to do that.
Yeah, I think everybody agrees that that's not currently tenable, even if some would want it. But we try.
I don't think it's ever.
We try to, on this program, set aside the impossible and just talk about policy and thought experiments. But so I welcome Dan's points there. Michael in Rochester. Go ahead, Michael.
Yes. I mean, I think one of the main issues that nobody really talks about very much is the greed and, you know, the fact that the employers just aren't giving as much of a cut to the employees anymore. I mean, you talk about a $15 an hour minimum wage, which really isn't even that much money a week for a family or, you know, for an individual. You know, people are out there struggling. I am a small business owner myself, and I, you know, pay my employees $10 an hour, and you know, it's something I feel that I have to do in order to keep them here. And if there was a higher minimum wage, I feel that people will be spending a lot more money and I will be able to pay my employees a lot more.
Michael, where's your business based?
Where? In Rochester.
In Rochester. How many people do you employ?
Right now, just two. I'm a small little place.
Okay. Mike Durant, small business is your bailiwick. You want to jump in there? Go ahead.
Well, one, I'm happy that the small business is doing well enough to be able to do that, obviously. I think that it's not entirely true all across the board. We had a member that does small manufacturing in Syracuse, and what they were manufacturing were leather tags for pets. And it was husband and wife owned the business. They employed three people. They didn't pay those three people minimum wage. The husband and wife combined running this business, combined, husband and wife, $48,000 a year. Okay, not poverty, but combined, that's $48,000 a year. And they would hire two children, high school kids, that were autistic. And when minimum wage increased from $7.25 to $8.50, we're no longer able to do that because they're already struggling living in Syracuse at $48,000 combined family income. And so they had to let those kids go. So there's a lot of variations to minimum wage depending the type of business, where it's located, and what type of business it is. There's not a one-size-fits-all, which is why New York and our country has a free market system. So great for that small business, but that same story is not necessarily true for other types of business.
Colin and Greg?
You know, I just throw out there real quick, you know, and this is not a direct answer to the question, but I think it's valuable for people's information in terms of who we're listening to. The National Federation of Independent Business consistently claims to represent small business and is one of the major powerhouse lobbying groups in this country. I think people should take the moment and look up their funding sources and then answer for themselves if they really represent small business.
All right, Mike, go ahead and respond.
I just described to you we are a ballot-driven, member-driven organization. Our typical employee or member has 5 to 7 employees. I run the organization for the state of New York. The funding that I have, to be honest, I've operated on a flat operating budget here in New York for 5 years. Where our funding comes from on a national level, based on either our efforts as a plaintiff for the Affordable Care Act, where some did come from bigger business, but that was funding for the health care. They are not funding my operation. They are not funding my members, and they are not funding our organization year in and year out.
Let me also address another point here that I know Candace has been waiting to make on the line. When Governor Cuomo was in Rochester touting this minimum wage increase, he said, quote, "Raising the minimum wage will increase wages for New Yorkers about $3 billion. They will spend it. That's $3 billion into the economy overnight." And that is almost certainly a massive oversimplification. Economists, Kent Gardner and many others tell me, you can't just say $3 billion increase in wages, it goes right back into the economy. And at least, Colin O'Malley, isn't that an oversimplification that doesn't really do any good to this conversation?
I think it's an oversimplification that does a lot of good for the conversation, if that's fair.
But it's not true. You're not putting $3 billion directly into the economy.
No, certainly not. Certainly not. In fact, I think workers put in billions more into the economy that they're never given back because of massively profitable businesses that steal what they earn. So I would certainly argue that I think workers and everyday folks in our communities put way more in that they never see.
And the bottom line is you're saying is if we raise wages, they will spend a lot of that.
And yeah. I mean, you know, Walmart is not in our town going shopping at our local businesses. Many of their employees are. And so I think raising the wages of those folks will have a substantial positive impact on local small business.
Greg?
Well, we keep talking about Walmart and we keep talking about McDonald's. You know, I think Mike and I keep trying to focus on some small businesses and some individual, cases that hit a little more closer to home. But the governor's proposed increase, if it goes through, I'm not even going to touch the assembly, just on the governor's proposal.
Yes.
That's 44% in 3 or 4 years. The argument is that more of that's going to get spent into the economy, that those wage increases. Now, what they're going to get spent on is things that cost more money. A gallon of gas at a 40% increase goes from $2.62 to $3.77. Movie tickets for a family of four goes from $44 to $60.50. You're going to see these price increases. And if you're on the lower end of the wage scale, who's to say that if you go from $8.75 an hour to $9.50 an hour or $10 an hour, that becomes automatically disposable income that you're throwing around? I mean, that could be money being saved. That could be money being spent other places. The idea to the original question that the minute you raise minimum wage, $3.5 billion goes back into the economy, yes, is a massive oversimplification.
Mike Durant, last quick comment from you. What do you expect to happen in Albany? I know you've been trying to make your voices heard in the NFIB. What do you expect to happen with the wage?
I've learned in 15 years of working in Albany that the unexpected is usually what happens. I think that one of two things, something will happen in the budget, probably a differentiation between upstate and downstate if minimum wage does pass. What that number is, I don't know. I do think there needs to be an injection of a training wage conversation in the debate right now, one, so that any wage increase truly targets those impoverished or those in need as opposed to the teenager argument. And if it's not that big of a deal, as it's been alluded to, for teenagers earning minimum wage, then training wage should be a no-brainer. But also, it'll get removed, and we'll be dealing with it till June.
Colin, you expect this to get done this year? You think momentum is on the side of a higher wage?
In Albany, for a small amount, yeah.
Okay. We're going to talk about the fight for 15 next month, and I hope that this panel and more will join us. Colin O'Malley from Metro Justice, always nice to talk to you. Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Greg Barilla from Unshackle Upstate, thank you for taking the time.
Absolute pleasure, Evan.
Mike Durant from NFIB, the state director, thank you for taking the time, Mike.
Thank you.
And for all those who called and we couldn't even get through, this conversation is not over, so don't worry about that. Val, great job on the board today. Thanks for listening to Member-Supported Public Radio.
This program is a production of WXXI Public Radio. The views expressed do not necessarily represent